We live in the world, which is headed and run by the prince of the power of the air. But we live by the Spirit, discerning the times. For he who is spiritual discerns all things. Sharpen your discernment. Build your faith. Listen to the Word and World Team. Minister the Word of God through conversational theology, piercing the darkness of this present evil age.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again, because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping. And the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence.
Welcome back. This is Hampton Keithley with Bob Brandon, and we are continuing our book review of How the West Won by Rodney Stark. And today we're going to do chapter 14. So how are you, Bob?
I'm fine, Hampton. Thank you. I hear you've got a rainstorm going on.
Yes, we had a good old Texas rain that washed everything away, including our two dogs.
Now, your dogs are pretty tough, aren't they?
Yes, they're my son's dogs.
Well, how tough are they?
They were so tough that in Port Lavaca, where they were before, they killed an alligator.
Oh, my gosh. So they struggle in a storm, right?
Yeah, one of them panicked and scooted under the fence. The other one ripped the fence down to get to it. So they're gone. We haven't found them yet.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad we're able to hook up this morning. So I'm excited about this material.
Yeah, me too. I think this was the most memorable chapter of the book, because I read this book, I want to say, 8 years ago for the first time. And it's this one stuck with me. And, yeah. You know, I've mentioned the Robin Hood movie and the telescope scene where the Muslim gives Robin Hood the telescope.
Right.
And, you know, I think I believed that in the movie till I read that chapter a few years back. And so that kind of stuck with me. So that's what we're going to be talking about today, is the exposing Muslim illusions. But before we get started, did you want to do some Daniel?
I did. And so I want to point out a couple things before we finish the last chapter of Daniel. One is, we read this 2 times ago, but in Daniel chapter 10, there's a sentence that's fun for us. This is Daniel chapter 10, verse 21. And Daniel writes, he's recording what the angel said to him. And so he writes, however, I will first tell you what is written in a dependable book. So I forgot to do it at the time, but I thought I'd take a minute now to remind everyone there's a library in heaven.
I thought of that one.
I know, it's a kind of a fun way to think about it. So there are.
Well, there's at least one book we know of.
Well, when I say them, it'll come to your mind. Oh, okay. You'll go, oh, yeah.
You know what book I'm referring to, right?
Yeah. So there's a library in heaven. There's 3 books, but I don't know how many volumes. Like, I'm certain in one of these books, there must be a couple million volumes. But here we go. I'm reading from David Aun in his commentary on the book of Revelation. This commentary just covers the first 5 chapters. But it's mentioned in chapter 3, you know, like Jesus says, you know, I will not blot your name out of the book of life. So Aun writes, there's a small library of at least 3 types of heavenly books referred to in the Old Testament and early Jewish and early Christian literature. One is the Book of Life. And then he lists all the references there. So, you know, your name, for instance, Hampton's written in that book. You have eternal life. So the second book in the heavenly library is the Book of Deeds. And you see that in, you know, a number of different books in the Bible, but that'll be mentioned, and all those references are here. Then the third type of book in heaven, this one, well, the first one's my favorite because that secures your eternal life. The Book of Deeds, I'm not that big on because mine aren't going to be that great. But the third one's cool. The Book of Destiny. That's Book of Destiny? The Book of Destiny. You know, for instance, David will pray, you know, weren't all my tears written down in your book before I was even formed? Right. So as a, for instance, you know, look at what we just read in Daniel chapter 10, verse 21. However, I will first tell you what is written in a dependable book. I would take that as a reference to the Book of Destiny.
Okay.
Now, this is not a for certain thing, but it's just a fun little tidbit. I'm sure you, along with everyone else, has experienced it at least one time in life, what's called deja vu.
Mm-hmm.
In an odd way, could somehow the Book of Destiny figure into an explanation of that?
In what way?
Well, like if you're reading a book and you flip some pages ahead and then you go back and pick up where you were before you started reading ahead, and so you read that material again, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You'd be seeing it again. Who knew? I'm not saying that's a real explanation of that. It's just fun to think about. Right. So anyway, books are going to come up again in this last chapter of Daniel. But keep in mind, as we read Daniel chapter 12, this really, you know, there's a big 12 in the margin and then a verse 1. Daniel didn't write that way. And there's really no break in the context of what's going on. But here's the final chapter. And one last thing to keep in mind, remember from Deuteronomy, we know that when God established the nations, he did so according to the heavenly realm, such that there are angels in charge of different nations. So just keep that in mind. So here's Daniel chapter 12. At that time, the great prince who watches over your people will arise. There will be a time of distress, unlike any other from the nation's beginning up to that time. But at that time, your own people, all those whose names are found written in the book, will escape. Many of those who sleep in the dusty ground will awake, some to everlasting life and others to shame and everlasting abhorrence. But the wise will shine like the brightness of the heavenly expanse, and those bringing many to righteousness will be like the stars forever and ever. But you, Daniel, close up these words and seal the book until the time of the end. Many will dash about and knowledge will increase. I, Daniel, watched as two others stood there, one on each side of the river. One said to the man clothed in linen who was above the waters of the river, when will the end of these wondrous events occur? Then I heard the man clothed in linen who was over the waters of the river as he raised both his right and left hands to the sky and made an oath by the one who lives forever. It is for a time, times, and half a time. Then, when the power of the one who shatters the holy people has been exhausted, all these things will be finished. I heard, but I did not understand. So I said, sir, what will happen after these things? He said, "Go, Daniel, for these matters are closed and sealed until the end of the time of the end. Many will be purified, made clean, and refined. The wicked will go on being wicked. None of the wicked will understand, though the wise will understand. From the time that the daily sacrifice is removed, the abomination that causes desolation is set in place. There are 1,290 days. Blessed is the one who waits and attains to the 1,335 days. But you should go your way until the end. You will rest. And then at the end of the days, you will arise to receive what you've been allotted." That's how the book of Daniel ends, Hampton.
Yeah.
So, a great book of the scriptures, and something we need to keep in mind all the time as we survey world history through the lens of Stark, as he takes us through how the West was won. And again, what he means by won, or how the West won. And what he means by that is not necessarily, or the way I interpret it is not, we arrived, you know, we're the greatest culture ever, or something like that. I think what it basically means is we established a political system that allowed for the greatest good possible for the common guy until Christ returns.
Right.
Given the sin nature of humankind, we probably have the best system, but that's fallen now. And I'd like to give a illustration, if I might.
Okay.
So, you know, I really enjoy the sciences, so I dabble in reading about them as much as I can. So I've been re-digging into the elemental chart in chemistry. That's such an amazing tool. I mean, what a benefit to mankind to understand the elements. Once you understand them, boy, you can do things with them. However, I want to give a little, very brief, you know, like 20 second. So lay some groundwork for that. So initially, you know, back in like 1885, you know, around those days, they were starting to, the chemists of the time were starting to understand this might be a really important thing to try to identify all the elements they could, and then determine if there was logic to the sequence of the, like if they could put them in order.
Mm-hmm.
And the first way they began to order them was by like how many protons they figured was in the nucleus. Mm-hmm. Essentially, they're dealing with atomic mass. So they're trying to weigh them, you know, some are heavier than others. So they'd put them in order that way. And then soon enough, they started to figure out, you know, the electrons have a lot to say about how these elements interact. It's not just their protons. And so then they began to discover that there were what they call today shells, like there's orbitals, like the electrons, you know, fly around, I guess, to use that term, the nucleus, and they do so in patterns. And the electrons, you know, exist at different levels of energy. And according to that, in your outer shell, if you have 8 electrons, you are an incredibly stable element. That's the goal. Every element wants to get 8 electrons in their outer shell. So anyway, once they began to figure that out, then the order of the elements became much clearer, up to the point today where they've got them in all rows and columns, and all of that makes sense if you understand.
That's based on electrons?
Well, part of it, you know, the nuclear mass is still important, but the electrons are just huge, really determines a lot of the activity. So anyway, my point is this. You can't see these things with your eye. You can't see the electrons. You can't see the protons. However, if you correctly identify them, you can precisely predict how they're going to interact. with other elements. Precisely. So think about trying to piece together something like what's happened with COVID, right? Think of that like an elemental chart. Think of it like if there were certain things you knew, all the unfolding events would make sense. And if you didn't know those basic fundamental things that are unseen to us as the average citizen, the whole thing doesn't make any sense. Like, we know the vaccine doesn't prevent you from getting COVID. Well, then what is it then, right? Like, that makes no sense. That's not how other vaccines work, right? You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. But if you knew what was going on behind the scenes, that would make perfect sense. So here's an item that I picked up last week. You and I get that same new access to that same newsletter from Peter Halligan. And one of the items in there this past week was unearthed through a Freedom of Information request, FOIA. So the FDA got subpoenaed with this FOIA request. They have to release certain information, which they wouldn't normally do, right? They want it kept unseen, but the FOIA, in a sense, made it visible. And what came out of this particular request was that the FDA subcontracted out to the tune of $40 million an independent group to handle the VAERS reports. So VAERS, V-A-E-R-S, Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. Now, if you were the FDA, why would you do that? Here comes a new vaccine. Why would you pay $40 million to an outside group to handle reports that were going to come in? In the contract, it states the reason that they wanted to subcontract this, because they thought there would be at least 1,000 VAERS reports a day. Now, why would you think that? What you thought, right? That so much that you spent $40 million on that. In other words, you knew what was going to happen. So, yeah, my point is, whose model does that fit? Like we would say of the elemental chart in chemistry, whose model do these elements reflect? Well, it reflects the model that there's protons, neutrons, and electrons, and they're arranged such and such, even though you can't see that with the naked eye. Doesn't everything that's happened in the last 3 years or so fit the model we've been saying?
Mm-hmm. It does.
And it doesn't fit the model that the FDA, the NIH, all the alphabet groups that are concerned with national health, they are not good people. There is huge subterfuge going on, and people are being killed on purpose. That perfectly fits the model we've been saying. So anyway, just an illustration. The last application of that is this. The same type of thing, like trying to determine what's unseen. And by the way, the book of Hebrews gives that as a critical element in the definition of faith. Faith is the assurance of things hoped for and the conviction of things unseen. So as we go through world history through the eyes of Stark, what's unseen in Stark's perspective is the book of Daniel. This is all going to work out exactly how God said, right? It's all Spain rises, England rises, the other nations, right? As we watch them unfold, Muslim culture. But it picture, Jesus gives a fantastic illustration of this, the end of Matthew. He says, these, you know, you're going to hear of wars and rumors of wars, but these things are just birth pangs. as if the world is giving birth. And that's how I see world history ever since I read that verse. That, you know, imagine a fetus in the womb and it's shifting and changing minute by minute. And there's points in that development where you can't tell what that thing is. And then some parts of it become clear, and then they sort of disappear and come back and so on. And finally, you give birth to a fully formed human infant. And that's what I think we're reading about, right? We're watching kingdoms rise and fall, but it's all just very much like the fetal development of a human. So if you have that as your unseen data, then you can make sense of the world events. It's all heading for the goal that God has set out for it. And the ultimate goal, just so we're clear on this for all our listeners, is that Jesus Christ, the second Adam, sits on his throne in Jerusalem, ruling the world. That's the goal of history. That's what all this is heading towards. So anyway, I just wanted to lay it out like that. Thanks for your patience.
Okay, well, let's start on the exposing Muslim illusions.
Oh, please.
I'm just going to read the intro. In 1520, 4 years after Charles V became King of Spain, and 3 years after Martin Luther posted his 95 Theses, Suleiman became the 10th Sultan to rule the Ottoman Empire. Immediately, the 26-year-old Turk began to pursue his boyhood dream of conquering the West and imposing the true faith on the Christian infidel. It would be a two-pronged attack, sending a huge army overland into Europe through the Balkans and taking control of the Mediterranean in order to land armies on the coasts of Italy, France, and Spain. The plan was so monumental that Suleiman continues to be known as Suleiman the Magnificent. Even though after he had scored a few unimportant victories, Europeans smashed his armies and sank his navy, just as they had done to his ancestors' forces centuries before during the Crusades. Despite this record, far too many recent Western historians promulgate politically correct illusions about Islamic might, as well as spurious claims that once upon a time, Islamic science and technology were far superior to that of a backward and intolerant Europe. But as Suleiman discovered, wishing doesn't make it so.
So, I mean, I can't read that opening without laughing a number of times. Here's the first one. We've done this before, but don't you love the titles these guys get? Like Suleiman the Magnificent. I'm sure, you know, history's going to look back on me and call me Bob the Below Average. There's a hilarious Far Side cartoon about that. Go ahead, Anthony.
Well, but it's, you know, the irony is he failed.
Miserably.
And then, you know, he gets the title. He probably gave it to himself or something, but
there's a great Far Side about that. So here's this guy coming home to his hut after a hard day's work, and he's all beat down, and his wife is standing at the door of her hut angrily. She has her hands on her hips and the guy's head is bowed down, and she says, "And another thing, I'm tired of people calling you Alexander the Pretty Good." Oh, man. It's so funny. Here's another funny part of this to me. So, you know, I've mentioned this a few times. I like to ask the swimmers trivia questions. And I remember asking them one day a couple years ago, what was Suleiman the Magnificent's wife's name? And here's one of the reasons why I coach is simply to be around that age group. Mm-hmm. They are so funny. So I remember, you remember Asen, mm-hmm. who swam very fast last week, by the way. Here's a little aside. So you remember times right? You remember like Josiah's 100 free is 200 free.
Mm-hmm.
Asen went 150 in the 200 back. Pretty good. Wow. Yeah, pretty good. So 150 point something, but it was low.
I think Josiah's 200 fly was 209.
Maybe. Yeah.
So that's, you know.
Yeah, 19.
That's really fast.
Yeah. So anyway, so I asked Asen, who was Suleiman the Magnificent's wife? What was her name? And he thought about it for a second. He goes, Mrs. Suleiman. They're so funny. So I had to give him half credit. But her name was Roxolana. So if somebody asks you that, Hampton, just say Roxolana.
Okay. I don't think anybody's going to be asking me.
Okay.
Well, his first section is called Misleading Victories. And so he goes into quite a bit of detail about a couple battles where Muslims did win. One of them is in Constantinople. And I think they had 80,000 soldiers against 7,000, you know, inside the walls of Constantinople. And he made the point that the city was so big that pretty much all they had were walls. And if you line the soldiers up around the walls, they had 10-foot space between them. So they couldn't really concentrate the soldiers where they attacked, but they wasted a ton of time with their big cannon, 27-foot long cannon. And it took so long to load that, by the time they would blow a hole in the wall, they were able to patch it before they could
fire again. Yeah.
And then what they said, after 5 days or something like that, the cannon exploded, killed the gun crew, the guy who in Hungarian, it was.
Yeah. What wasn't a Muslim guy that been.
Yeah. It wasn't a Muslim that invented or made the cannon. It was a Hungarian.
Right.
And so they finally tried to dig tunnels and, anyway, they finally overwhelmed them, but that was because they had so many people. And then they had talked about the island of Rhodes, where the Knights Hospitallers lived. I guess those are the guys that left Jerusalem at the very end and went and started another place. They lived there on Rhodes. And again, it was a long, drawn-out battle, and they were greatly outnumbered. But then in all these other places, like Malta, Vienna, Lepanto, pretty much everywhere else they tried to conquer the Europeans, they were defeated.
Yeah. When you summarize, let me just jump in real quick, because we have to summarize this material. It's just too deep. But when we say, for instance, they were greatly outnumbered. Okay. Here's the battle at Rhodes. 70,000 Ottoman troops against 500 knights. And then the knights, had some auxiliary guys, 2,000 of them. So it's 70,000 to 2,500. And I mean, the battle drags on and on and on, right? For weeks, the 500 guys hold them off for quite some time. It's fun to read about these.
Well, then they finally, I think, let them go because it was taking so long. This was one of the few times they honored their agreement, but they said that you can leave if you'll just leave. And so they left and went to Malta.
You're right. Correct.
And they lost all their sea battles. And one reason was better ships and cannons. One reason was the Westerners had rowers that were citizens that would join in the fight, or maybe even criminals who were promised freedom if they would join in the fight when they clashed or, got next to each other. And the Muslims had slaves who often would fight against them when they saw an opportunity to get free. So
let me jump in, because that's exactly right, but I won't. Since you're a movie guy, Hampton, I thought you would point this out. At the end of that section on Malta, Suleiman may not have known for several years that subsequent to their withdrawal to Crete, Charles V had ceded the island of Malta to the Knights of St. John in return for their sending one trained falcon annually to the Viceroy of Sicily. This inspired the plot of Dashiell Hammett's famous novel, The Maltese Falcon, and the classic Humphrey Bogart 1941 movie. So, and keep in mind, like while this Muslim invasion is going on and being thwarted, Europe's fighting a dozen other wars.
Right.
They're not massing all their forces to repel the Muslims. They're repelling their Muslims with literally a handful of guys.
Yes, and then when they were not so busy fighting amongst themselves and can devote their time to fighting the Muslims, they
wipe them out.
Yeah. He says here in one place, the attacks on Vienna were the high water mark of Islamic overland invasions of Europe. Amazingly, some recent historians cite the three attempts to take Vienna as evidence of the Ottomans' military superiority over Europeans. That's a little bit like claiming that the defeat of the Armada demonstrated Spain's naval superiority.
Yeah, they were so great. It took three times to try to take Vienna, and Europe's barely even fighting. Europe's fighting not with just one arm tied behind their back, but both arms, both legs, and they're still home. You know, that also reminds me, Rush Limbaugh's passed away, of course, but I'll never stop laughing at the way he would introduce his show sometimes when he would say, you know, Rush Limbaugh, with half my brain tied behind my back, just right, to make it fair.
Yeah. Funny. One thing that I thought was real interesting was, and I don't want to just read this last paragraph about the military stuff, a bizarre footnote to the Battle of Lepanto. Victorious Christian sailors looting Turkish vessels still afloat or gone aground discovered an enormous fortune in gold coins in Sultana, the captured flagship of Ali Pasha. Fortunes nearly as huge were found in the galleys of several other Muslim admirals. As Victor Davis Hansen explained, without a system of banking, fearful of confiscation should he displease the Sultan, and always careful to keep his assets hidden from the tax collectors, Ali Pasha toted his huge personal fortune to Lepanto. Ali Pasha was not a peasant hiding harvest surplus, but a member of the upper elite. If such a person could find no safe investments and dared not leave his money at home, how could anyone else hope to do better? It was precisely this repressive command economy that explains the lack of progress in the Ottoman Empire and why, in order to compete with the West, the Ottomans had to buy military technology and experts from Europe.
Yeah, that's at the end of that section on that famous sea battle that, you know, the Westerners just completely wiped them out. Completely. This massive Ottoman fleet got destroyed. And like you're saying, they found all this gold on these ships, and it's because they can't bank. There's no, you know, they have no safety in a bank. They don't have a banking system, so they have to carry their money with them. Yeah, that's how advanced they were.
Very interesting. So the next section is allusions about Islamic culture. I'm just going to read first page. It says, it has long been the received wisdom that while Europe slumbered through the Dark Ages, science and learning flourished in Islam. The well-known historian Bernard Lewis advanced this view when he wrote that Islam had achieved the highest level so far in human history in the arts and sciences of civilization, and that intellectually medieval Europe was a pupil and in a sense dependent on the Islamic world. But then Lewis argued, Europeans suddenly began to advance by leaps and bounds, leaving the scientific and technological and eventually the cultural heritage of the Islamic world far behind them. Hence the question Lewis posed in the title of his book, What Went Wrong?
nothing went wrong. The belief that once upon a time Muslim culture was superior to that of Europe is at best an illusion. And what would be the other alternative? A lie?
Correct.
To ask what went wrong is the equivalent of asking why Spain fell, when in fact the collapse of the Spanish Empire revealed that Spain had never risen, but had remained a backward medieval society. So too with Islam.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, another word, that first sentence begins, it has long been the received wisdom. So we have a phrase for that, don't we?
Yeah, that's social imaginary.
The social imaginary. It's not correct. The model they're working from is wrong. So let's pause there just for a quick second. Why are they wrong? What is beneath, like what model do we need to have in our mind that helps explain why these scholars are wrong? Because it's easy to say, remember I sent you that video this week, like it was making fun of like a liberal guy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even want to rehash it. That was funny. Okay. But the point of that was stupidity. These scholars aren't dumb. So why are they saying, you know, in mass what they're saying? Because they're not dumb. What's in their worldview that's causing them to be mistaken? And I would say they very much want a top-down world government.
I think they do. And I also think it goes back to Rousseau and his, you know, where he said that the problem with the world was Christianity.
Yes.
Cramping their style.
Yeah. So they'll belittle Christianity whenever they can, and they will promote top-down heavy government.
Right.
But at all costs, they'll do those two things. So that's the lens they're looking through. So they're not dumb. They just are looking through those lenses, and that they'll explain everything in those terms. Stark is just pointing out the inaccuracies. He's being gentle about it. You know, a lot of the guys he's talking about are his peers. I'm sure he sees them at conferences and stuff. So he doesn't want to say you're lying, right? He'll say, well, at best you're mistaken or something right. Like that. It's an illusion. Go ahead.
So then he says, to the extent that Muslim elites acquired a sophisticated culture, they learned it from their subject peoples. As Lewis put it, without seeming to fully appreciate the implications, Arabs inherited the knowledge and skills of the ancient Middle East, of Greece, and of Persia. That is, the sophisticated culture, so often attributed to Muslims, more often referred to as Arabic culture, was actually the culture of the Dhimmis, Dhimmis. Is that how you'd say that, you think?
It is.
The conquered people. It was the Judeo-Christian Greek culture of Byzantium, combined with the remarkable learning of heretical Christian groups such as the Copts and the Nestorians, plus extensive knowledge from Zoroastrian Persia, and the great mathematical achievements of the Hindus, keep in mind the early and extensive Muslim conquests in India. This legacy of learning, including much that had originated with the ancient Greeks, was translated into Arabic, and portions of it were somewhat assimilated into Muslim culture. But even after having been translated, this learning continued to be sustained primarily by the Dhimmi populations living under Muslim regimes. For example, as the scholar Samuel H. Moffat observed, the earliest scientific book in the language of Islam was a treatise on medicine by a Syrian Christian priest in Alexandria, translated into Arabic by a Persian Jewish physician. As in this example, not only did Dhimmis originate most Arab science and learning, but they even did most of the translating into Arabic. That did not transform this body of knowledge into Arab culture. Rather, as the remarkable historian of Islam, Marshall G.S. Hodgson, noted, those who pursued natural science tended to retain their older religious allegiances as Dhimmis, even when doing their work in Arabic.
Yeah. So it's those with a Western mindset that were actually providing whatever real culture there was, whatever real learning actually was still coming from the West.
Right. And they maintained it. And he has a couple other sentences over the next page I just want to highlight. In this much admired book written to acknowledge the Arabs' enormous contributions to science and engineering, Donald R. Hill admitted that very little could be traced to Arab origins and that most of the contributions originated with conquered populations. Many of the Muslim world's most famous scholars were Persians, not Arabs. And then a little further on, what may have misled so many historians is that most contributors to Arabic science were given Arabic names and their works were published in Arabic, and that being the official language of the land. So I thought that was interesting. They point to some scientist, with an Arabic
Sure.
name, but he was really a Nestorian Christian.
Sure. It's sort of like, if we were back in ancient Babylon, what's
Well,
the
yeah.
first thing those guys did was change the captives' names, right?
Right.
And gave them Babylonian names. Well, if you use those Babylonian names, they sound Babylonian,
Right.
but they're
Good analogy.
Jewish. Yeah.
The so-called Arabic numerals were entirely of Hindu origin. We keep that name today, even. The same might be said for astronomy, although here too, most of the credit should go not to the Arabs, but to Hindus and Persians. And then he says the many claims that the Arabs achieved far more sophisticated medicine than had previous cultures are as mistaken as those regarding Arabic numerals. Muslim or Arab medicine was, in fact, Nestorian Christian medicine. Even the leading Muslim and Arab physicians were trained at the enormous Nestorian Medical Center at Nisibis in Syria. Nisibis offered not only medicine, but the full range of advanced education, as did the other institutions of learning the Nestorians established, including the one at Jundishpur in Persia, which the distinguished historian of science, George Sarton, called the greatest intellectual center of the time. So it might have been an Arabian country, but it was run by Christians.
Yeah, and then don't they list the jobs that the Nestorian Christians
Oh,
are
yeah.
good at? And they dominate these fields: accountants, architects, astrologers, bankers, doctors, merchants, philosophers, scientists, scribes, and teachers. All Christian, right? All from Western roots.
Yeah.
And then, so then it goes on. As late as the middle of the 11th century, Muslim writer Nasir E. Khrusaw reported, "Truly, the scribes here in Syria, as is the case of Egypt, are all Christians, and it's most usual for the physicians to be Christians." In Palestine, under Muslim rule, according to the monumental history by Moishe Gil, the Christians had immense influence and positions of power, chiefly because of the gifted administrators among them who occupied government posts despite the ban in Muslim law against employing Christians, or who were part of the intelligentsia of the period, owing to the fact that they were outstanding scientists, mathematicians, physicians, and so on. Those are Muslim guys saying that.
Yeah.
So he's shattering the illusion.
The one other paragraph I have highlighted here that he says even many of the most partisan Muslim historians, including the famous English convert to Islam and translator of the Quran, Marmaduke Pickthall, agree that sophisticated Muslim culture originated with the conquered populations. What has largely been ignored is that the culture could not keep up with the West because so-called Muslim culture was largely an illusion resting on a complex mix of dhimmi cultures. As soon as the dhimmis were repressed as heretical, the culture would be lost. Hence, when the Muslims stamped out nearly all religious nonconformity in the 14th century, Muslim backwardness came to the fore.
Yeah, very good. That also, you know, impels me to make a comment. So I remember years, I mean, maybe 20 years ago or so, it has always bothered me, but for some reason this went up to the front burner. When, you know, I'd ask people a biblical question and they wouldn't know. And I'd say, well, have you read the Bible? And oh, of course, a universal answer, right? Oh, yes. And you know, they haven't, right? But they say they have. So it's frustrating to everybody, right? When people want to, you know, present their view as informed and they haven't read the thing. So I thought, you know, if that's going to bother me, I need to read the Quran, because I don't want to criticize the Quran without reading it. Mm-hmm. I don't want to just read about it. So did some research, got what I thought was the best copy of the Quran and read it. Everyone should do that. Because if you do that, you will be so amazed that there is nothing in there. That book is nowhere near the Bible. Nowhere near it. I don't mean it's just gobbledygook, like it's from a culture that I don't understand. There's nothing in there. You would not read that book on your own and then compare Islam to Christianity. You say those are two completely different things. One of them's real. The other thing's some charlatan with a burr in his saddle.
Interesting.
You should read it. There's nothing there.
I probably should. Well, he talks about the tolerant Muslims, tolerant in quotes, and says a common refrain of both scholarly and popular histories is that in contrast with Christian brutality against Jews and heretics, Islam showed remarkable tolerance for conquered people, treated them with respect, and allowed them to pursue their faith without interference. Thus, Moorish Spain has been hailed as a shining example of civilized enlightenment and the ornament of the world. The truth about life under Muslim rule is quite different. And said the Quran forbids forced conversions. So they didn't force people. What they did was they gave them a choice, convert or die.
Okay, can we pause there for a second? So when he says... you know, the Quran has he read that? Because I remember reading that book and coming away thinking it does say that. So I'm not sure Stark is that. I doubt if he's read the Quran.
You say it does the Quran forbid conversion, forced conversions?
No, it doesn't forbid that.
Oh, it doesn't.
No, okay. It wants that.
Yeah, kill the infidels.
Yeah, promulgates that. Yeah.
Well, there is I think something. Do you remember the people of the book?
Yeah.
And that's Jews and Christians. So they were supposed to be exempted.
Yeah.
But it didn't work out that way.
Yeah.
So he has a bunch of different examples of massacres of Christians and people of other religions. And then he says, and then came Tamerlane.
Yeah, it's an interesting name for a Muslim guy.
Yeah. And evidently he was pretty vicious and he killed a couple hundred thousand people, I think was the number.
Yeah.
And then go ahead.
What was Muhammad? What was his profession?
I don't know.
It's a general. It's a war guy. Okay, go ahead.
It says, by the end of the 14th century, only tiny remnants of Christianity and Judaism remained scattered in the Middle East and North Africa, having been almost completely destroyed by Muslim persecution. And as the Dhimmis disappeared, they took the advanced Muslim culture with them. What they left behind was a culture so backward that it couldn't even copy Western technology and had to buy it, and often even had to hire Westerners to use it.
So. Yeah, they were, you know, they he made a point earlier. So, you know, when they come across Aristotle and Plato and all that, you know, the Islamic world is held up as like the torchbearers that, you know, were based on the famous Greek philosophers. They weren't. The Greek philosophers were not the be-all and the end-all. They were a good start, but there's plenty of stuff they thought that was wrong. You can't just quote Aristotle in the year 2023, right? Or Plato.
There's or 1400 been, even.
Yeah, there's been a lot of advancement since then.
Right.
So,
well, yes, where, that, he did point out that the Muslims of that time pretty much adopted Aristotle, and then, you know, and he never tested his stuff. He just would make things up and say,
yeah, they never progressed. Yeah. Right.
And so they adopted Aristotle, and so they did not continue. They continued to not do experiments.
Yeah. And so, it's that top down thinking, right? Yeah. Well, Aristotle's an authority, so that's it. If he said it, that's the way it is. Well, not necessarily.
Right. Well, his final paragraph conclusion is, so much then for the mystery of how Muslim culture was somehow lost or left behind. The notion that in the medieval era, Islamic culture was advanced well beyond Europe is as much an illusion as recent ones about an Arab Spring. The Islamic world was backward then, and so it remains. It's pretty hard on them.
Yeah. And it's just, by the way, this is all footnoted. All of this is researched, right? He's not, Stark isn't giving you his opinion. He's just pointing out what really happened in history.
Yeah, I think it's very well documented.
So I remember a guy, now you can't use one example and then say, see, this epitomizes Muslim culture. But I do have a friend that has done some work in the Middle East. So we're working with some of the wealthy oil guys that are, you know, from the different oil nations over there. Yeah, some of them, you know, they're just so wealthy, you know, that it's funny, their perspective on life. So they had this one young guy from one of these families, and he was, you know, greatly overweight and slovenly and stuff. So he's in counseling, and they're telling him, you know, you really need to work out. You know, that's got to be part of your program. You're coming in here for psychological counseling, but, you know, your physical well-being is a big part of that. So you got to work out. And they gave him a program. And so he paid someone to work out for him. You know, you just laugh, you know. And I'm not saying that characterizes all of the Middle East, but oh my gosh.
Oh, that's funny. I wish that worked. Okay, well, anything else?
That does it for today, Hampton.
Okay, well, I'll talk to you next time.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Therefore, I exhort you, brothers and sisters, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a sacrifice, alive, holy, and pleasing to God, which is your reasonable service. Do not be conformed to this present world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may test and approve what is the will of God, what is good and well-pleasing, and perfect.